Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, we're doing something a little different and bringing you our first interview. When we talk about how the Supreme Court operates, how it's structured, and how it goes about doing its work, we often treat the court as if it were static. But in fact, nearly every aspect of the court and its operations has changed substantially since its founding, including where it meets, its calendar, how cases get on the court's docket, how cases are briefed and argued, and how opinions are assigned and written. To take just one example, the original Supreme Court, appointed by George Washington, had only 6 members. In the 19th century, its size was increased several times, briefly as high as 10 justices, before settling at 9 shortly after the Civil War, where it stayed ever since. Many characteristics of the modern court, like the 9 justice size, have been stable for a very long time. But there's no guarantee they'll stay that way forever, and over the years, there's been no shortage of ideas about how the court could be improved, either on its own initiative or through outside action. One person who's thought a lot about changing the court, in ways large and small, is Gabe Roth, the executive director of an organization called Fix the Court that advocates for various reforms to the way the Supreme Court operates. I spoke with Gabe about Fix the Court and about his organization's recent proposal to limit the justices' terms on the bench. Now, on to the interview.
I'm speaking today with Gabe Roth, the executive director of Fix the Court, an organization that aims to educate the public about what it describes as the many problems plaguing the court and its justices, and hopes to create pressure for various reforms to the Supreme Court. So, Gabe, can you tell us a little about Fix the Court? Where did it come from? How long has it been around?
Sure, and thanks so much for having me, Mike. I started the organization in late 2014, actually when I was living in Chicago. Previously, I had been living in Washington, D.C., and I had a number of different clients when I was working in politics that had cases come before the justices, but sometimes the plaintiffs were in Maine or California or Texas, and it was really frustrating for them that they couldn't, well, they could come to the court if they wanted to spend the money to get a plane ticket and a hotel room, but generally, you know, it's a little bit cost prohibitive for some people, but you know, there's no way to experience the action of the court live as it unfolded, unlike in state courts or for Congress or even at the White House. So I started this organization called the Coalition for Court Transparency, and it was, you know, single issue organization, had conservatives, liberals, even some libertarians in the group, just trying to get the justices to open up the courtroom to broadcast access, specifically live audio and video. And, you know, we made a little bit of headway in terms of educating people about this issue, because a lot of folks don't know that most Supreme Court cases are only about an hour long. And if you want to experience the big ones, you got to camp out overnight on 1st Street and working with members of Congress to educate them about that. But when you peel back the onion a little bit more, you realize that there are other ways that make the Supreme Court the most powerful, least accountable institution in Washington. And as such, given that it's making these decisions on marriage and healthcare and life and death and voting and reproductive choice issues, you want an institution that's more accountable to the American people, that we know more about. So then that's sort of where these other issues came in terms of wanting to have the justices follow a code of conduct, to have them follow certain stock and recusal rules, have them put their financial disclosures online and tell the public when and where they're appearing in public, which they don't announce unlike politicians. So from this one issue, it just sort of ballooned into a bunch of issues and decided to start a separate organization that didn't have all these different coalition partners with different political perspectives. I'm, you know, a pretty straightforward down the middle guy. So it just made sense to me to form a nonpartisan group that advocated for these fixes to the Supreme Court and the rest of the federal judiciary.
It makes sense. A lot of your issues are centered around transparency. You mentioned that the live video coverage was what you got started with, but you know, you mentioned the formal adoption of a code of ethics, because right now the court has informal internal ethics rules that are not published anywhere and not formalized or codified anywhere. Publicized reasons for recusals from cases, as your organization has publicized. Sometimes we know the reasons why justices recuse from certain cases, but other times it's something of a mystery and we're left to kind of guess and try and figure that out. More detailed financial disclosures you also mentioned and information about public appearances of the justices. One area, and something we're going to go into a little more depth in this call, is the call for term limits for the justices. And that seems to me a little different, because rather than just a pure transparency issue, that's more of a structural change to the whole appointment process. I'm curious, Can you sum up how you would define the scope of Fix the Courts reform efforts? And what I mean is, the court is under a lot of scrutiny. There's no shortage of aspects of the court and its practices that have come under criticism. There are things like the court's rules, both the official rules of the Supreme Court and the unwritten practices, the way that law clerks are used, things like the cert pool, opinion assignment and writing practices, the role that the Chief Justice plays. There's a long list of things. How do you decide which of these issues are appropriate for Fix the Court?
You know, I think a lot of it is filling in the gap where issues aren't being addressed. And I know, you know, if you go to fixthecourt.com, we've got these six issues that you can see, or six fixes that you can see right off the top, linked to on the homepage. But we've definitely delved into other issues in terms, you know, we want the justices to periodically release health reports, just like presidents and presidential candidates do, for example. But generally, it's we're trying to get at just overall transparency issues that can be addressed and understood by the average American. I'm not a lawyer. You know, I have my degrees were in anthropology and politics and journalism. You know, I try as much as I can not to use Pacer, which is, you know, the or LexisNexis or Westlaw. I try to make things that are accessible, that average Americans are going to care about, that they might care about already in their politicians, and they may have not thought about those issues for their justices, but they should. The inside baseball of the court, I feel like, is already something that's scrutinized by the Supreme Court bar, and, you know, whether it be SCOTUS blog or Above the Law or other appellate blogs, you know, I want to talk about the things that the American people are going to be able to understand, and, you know, you don't need a law degree to concern yourself with it, and really just sort of make it consistent with what we're looking at when it comes to the political branches. There's, you know, if I've worked for politicians before, and every night before we went home, we listed where our politicians would be appearing the next day in public. The justices don't do that. I've never worked for a member of Congress, but I've spent plenty of time on Capitol Hill. They have to put their financial disclosures online every year, every May 15th. The justices don't put theirs online. Instead, they release them by paper. This year, they released them via thumb drives, which is a little bit of an improvement, but still, you know, we put them online, but they don't. So it's sort of, and similar things about stock rules that and recusal rules that the political branches, you know, obviously things a little bit different with stocks and recusals given who's in the White House right now, but, you know, in more normal times, you know, there's certain rules that have been followed since the Nixon administration. So it's really just sort of relating the basic transparency measures that the political branches have implemented in the last few decades that the Supreme Court, for whatever reason, have decided to exempt themselves from. And sure, they're different from the political branches. I get that. But at the same time, if they're going to be serving the American people for 10, 15, 30, 35 years, they should give just a little bit. And we're not asking for every, you know, I don't need to know where they live or what they're up when they're hanging out with their grandkids, but they should still have a little bit more accountability than they currently have. And, you know, to your point, I think it's just sort of the basic issues that the American people care about, not so much as, like, you know, which justice is or not, is not in the cert pool, which is a little bit more inside baseball.
That makes sense. So let's talk a little bit more about term limits.
Would love to.
So on June 29th, Fix the Court announced a new term limits proposal for the court. This isn't a new idea. That the basic idea of and even the specific length of term, a 18-year term, which would mean new justices would be coming and going every 2 years. That's been floating around for a while, and there have been, you know, several proposals by law professors giving different variations on that theme. But I want to dig into yours a little more deeply. But first, before we talk about the specifics of your proposal, can you talk a little about what you see as the problems with the current system that you're aiming to address?
Sure. So the history of the court is full of instances in which justices have not stepped down at what most people would deem a proper time, whether that be because a 30 or 35 year tenure is more feudal than democratic, whether that be because a number of justices have experienced mental decline while still on the bench. More than one would think. I actually just finished reading a book about that, and it details every single justice's reason for leaving the bench. And, I sort of knew this anecdotally from doing this work for a couple of years, but there are really just a very high number of individuals, both, I mean, in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, who have left the court, and maybe even some in the 21st, who have left the court without their full faculties. And to me, it's a math problem. You know, that every year that you are above age 70, you are more likely to actuarially not only just pass away, but also lose some of your mental faculties. And I feel like we can mitigate that fact a little bit through a number of different means, whether it be a mandatory retirement age, which many state Supreme Courts have and many foreign Supreme Courts have, whether it be through a term limit, which is what we're advocating for here, or whether it be through something that recently I've been working with federal appeals courts, circuit courts on, which is judicial wellness committees. That's something that the Ninth Circuit created in 2000 that a few other circuits have recently started creating, which basically comprises a number of initiatives that helps judges age with grace, that invites neurological experts to talk to aging judges and justices, that has a public assistance hotline to discuss potential decline in co-staff, that brings in Lumosity type games to help, to ensure that judges stay sharp. And that's the thing, is that, because the justices, they themselves make their own decision as to when they leave the bench, the chance for abuse in the sense of, justices staying on too long and the court covering for them is fairly high. And it's happened a lot. And if, this an 18-year term is not perfect, but at the same time, I think it would reduce the instance over time. It would reduce the instance of justices on the court who are experiencing mental decline.
And that's interesting. I like that while the term limits proposal would have some effect on this, the cognitive decline issue, I like that you're also tackling it from other directions, looking at things like wellness approaches and assessments of mental faculties. Let's talk a little about where we are right now. So let me try and kind of set the stage a little. The Constitution says federal judges, quote, shall hold their offices during good behavior. And this has been interpreted since the founding to mean a lifetime appointment, absent some behavior that leads to impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few implications of this. It means that court vacancies are relatively infrequent.
Mm-hmm.
They're irregular. They're unpredictable. And to some degree, the justices can control the timing of vacancies by choosing when to retire. Obviously, if they die suddenly, that's off the table. But to some degree, they can control when a vacancy comes up. So that's, those are some characteristics of the current situation that to a greater or lesser degree are of concern to people. So let's look a little bit at your proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic idea, without getting into the details, is the president would be entitled to appoint a new justice in the first and third year of each four-year presidential term.
Correct.
And then after each of these appointments, the longest currently serving justice would become a senior justice, leaving only 9 active justices at a time. So effectively, you'd have an 18-year term for each justice.
Exactly. Yeah. 2 times 9, 18. The justices that would be senior justices, they would keep their salary and pension and their offices in the Supreme Court building. They'd be able to ride circuit as happened by legislation for the first 120 years of the court's existence, but then has happened by custom in the subsequent 100 plus years where retired justices serve on lower appellate courts. But yeah, they would and they'd be able to fill in the case of a vacancy. That we part of this proposal is a solution to this prolonged vacancy idea. That if a justice were to pass away, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg, were to pass away tomorrow, then there would be a justice to fill in. You'd go, in reverse order of who, or in the order of the most recently retired justice. So that would be Stevens, I guess. Stevens would have the right of first refusal, and he's 97, and I'm not sure he's going to want to do that. But if not him, then Souter, and Souter's still healthy. He's hearing cases on the First Circuit from time to time. So it would prevent this prolonged vacancy situation which really paralyzed the court for 2 terms. So this proposal solves a number of issues. One, there's no way the founders wanted the justices serving for 30 or 35 years. I don't, you know, I know John Marshall is sort of the exception to the rule because he was one of the earliest and he served about 30. But, you know, you look through the history of the court and from the, you know, the first 180-year history of the court, the average tenure was 15 years. In the last 50 or so years, the average tenure has been 26 and it's rising. I think it's actually up to 27 now. So life expectancy is longer. And justices are serving longer and longer. So that solves this problem where you've got this incredibly powerful institution and you have these, don't have these individuals who are serving just, you know, indeterminately. There was this, recently there was an 11-year period where there was no new justice. 11 years, no new justice. And that was the longest in the court's history. That was 94 to 2005. So it solves that. And then it also solves the vacancy problem. And it also talks about, you know, what happens if there's a rash of vacancies, if there's even a third vacancy within a single presidential term. Our proposal covers that. So we're trying to, you know, a lot of these proposals in the past have sort of, you know, hit one or two of the issues, but this, I think what's different with our proposal is that it really, it solves for X, for Y, and for Z. So, and hopefully it'll be taken up by Congress.
That's interesting. And, you know, you definitely have, you have a point that certainly life expectancies have increased and the average tenure on the Supreme Court has gone up quite a bit over the years. But, you know, you did mention John Marshall, who was a founding era figure appointed in 1801, and he did serve for 34 years, still one of the longest serving justices ever. And, you know, although, again, yes, he was unusual for that time period, but Joseph Story, appointed in 1812, he's still in the top 10 longest serving.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I don't know that it was inconceivable, you know, to the founders at the time that there would be people serving for 30 plus years. The founders were, you know, familiar with public figures who served for long periods of time at the.
Yeah, no, look, I'd pay a lot of money to be able to go to back to, you know, July 4th, 1826, which is, I think, the day on which both Adams and Jefferson died, and to say, and to ask them, look, you know, John Marshall's been on the bench for 25 years. What do y'all think? But, you know, we can't do that. You know, Alexander Hamilton, who for some reason is in the vogue these days, he had, you know, in his Federalist paper, he said, you know, no mandatory retirement age. And I hate to be with the anti-federalists on this, but there were some anti-federalist papers that were pushing for an entire retirement age. The phrase that we lifted for our Constitution, for Article 3, the good behavior phrase, was part of a 1701 British law that was trying to establish judicial independence from the crown. 1701. That's insane. Like the fact that we're still determining our top judicial officials in the United States of America based on a concept of judging that existed 316 years ago. It just doesn't pass muster to me. And I'm not trying to be an iconoclast here. Many people before me have come up and thought about this idea, but you know, you look through the literature and the history and the idea of having a Stevens serve 35 years, a Douglas serve 35 years, a Rehnquist serve 33 years, a Scalia serve 29 years, a Kennedy serve 29 years. It just doesn't hold up to me.
That brings up another point. While it's certainly true that, you know, this is a, you know, an old practice that goes back, you know, to the Constitution. And as you noted, the language that was used is based on earlier language. And it's certainly worth asking whether, given the age of this and the changes that have happened in the intervening time, whether it's worth reconsidering it. But many people would consider the good behavior, you know, life tenure of the justices to be kind of one of the hard-coded provisions of the Constitution, like two senators from each state, that even if there's contemporary reasons why people might want to change that, it would require a constitutional amendment rather than just a statutory change. So I wanted to ask you about that, because there have been previous proposals to do, you know, similar things that have suggested that a constitutional amendment would be needed to really make this sort of a change. But your proposal advocates doing it just by a statute.
Sure. Yeah. I'd be in favor of a constitutional amendment. There are efforts to amend the Constitution that are going on right now. This whole Article 5 NGO is trying to get state legislatures across the country involved in these ways to amend the Constitution. One of their platforms is term limits for the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, we're a nonpartisan group, and unfortunately Article 5 is fairly partisan in a certain direction, so we're not going to join up with them. But, you know, I'd be in favor of having a constitutional amendment. You know, I think the jury's out from law professors out there. Obviously, we've got, you know, a couple dozen law professors who signed on to our proposal that was released last month. But, you know, if I had the manpower, I'd love to go state to state and talk to legislatures, and see if they'd be in favor of a constitutional amendment. But, you know, I think that the legislation is written in a way that maintains the life tenure of Article III judges, and I think it would pass constitutional muster. I mean, what are the justices going to do? They're going to deem a law that ends their tenure unconstitutional? I mean, I'd be kind of selfish. So I don't know if that would happen. But look, like I said, there's a lot of different approaches. You know, my theory about fix the court and Supreme Court transparency is there are a lot of different approaches. We're a big tent organization, and, you know, I just wrote an op-ed it was actually in the Buffalo News about a mandatory retirement age, which actually passed the Senate in 1954, a week before Brown v. Board. So it got buried a little bit in the news cycle. But, you know, mandatory retirement age, constitutional amendment legislation, all of that it's something that we'd be in favor of. I think the legislative language here is such that it is it maintains a certain fidelity to the Constitution. And we were very careful when I was working with Alan Morrison at GW and Paul Carrington of Duke and Caroline Fredrickson of ACS to really home in on the language that would be consistent with the constitutional directives.
I mean, it seems to me that the counter argument would be, you know, yes, it formally keeps life tenure, but it kind of keeps life tenure while removing the powers of the office after a specified term, which kind of seems like circumvention of the constitutional framework for the Supreme Court. I guess the bigger concern would be if there are serious constitutional questions, even if there are good arguments as to the constitutionality of this proposal, does it potentially set up the risk of a constitutional crisis of a sort if there is a strong argument for the unconstitutionality on the other side, and if that is bought into by the justices, then you have a situation where the Supreme Court is put in a position of judging its own constitutionality of its own limits. You know, is this asking for trouble?
There would be a lot of potential for recusals. Look, I think I like looking at like the constitutional history and the history of the court dealing with these issues that affect them personally. The best example I can give you is the 1974 Ethics in Government Act that was, 1978 Ethics in Government Act that was passed after Watergate, required the justices and all federal judges to release annual financial disclosure reports. And a couple of lower federal judges said that they don't want to put out, you know, release what their investments are. And they, you know, took the government to court and lost in the Fifth Circuit in a case called Duplantier versus U.S. And the justices didn't grant cert. And basically, by not granting cert, they held up the Fifth Circuit standard that said the justices, that they themselves, as justices in the rest of the federal judiciary, do have to fill out these and publish these annual financial disclosure reports. Otherwise, you know, there's not a lot of other guidance or similar cases or similar instances where the justices are ruling about their own institutional. I guess another one is the last year they denied cert also in a case about a Maryland man who protested on the Supreme Court's front plaza. A district judge said that the 1949 law that was passed that said that parading or protesting on the grounds of the Supreme Court was illegal, that law was unconstitutional. It was overturned by the appeals court, said, you know, that law is constitutional, and this very flowery Kennedy-esque sort of language that seemed to be more, you know, because it's the D.C. Circuit ingratiating themselves to their potential future colleagues, if any of them were called up to the bigs, than actually being grounded in any sort of First Amendment law. But that's probably, you know, my own personal opinion. But again, there was a case where the justices were talking about whether or not folks could protest on their turf and they turned it away. So they denied it cert and let the appeals court ruling stand. So yeah, I don't even know who would have stand. Would the justices have standing? So who would have standing if we're suing over this law if it passes? I'm not sure. I think that you're right. There are a lot of constitutional questions that are raised. Frankly, they aren't ones that concern me a whole lot. I think that the idea of having an institution whose tenure is more reasonable, rational, modern, and consistent with what the framers probably wanted, and consistent with, frankly, what every other Supreme Court in the United States, all the state Supreme Courts, save Rhode Island, and every Supreme Court in the world does. I think that would be okay for the institution stateside to adopt.
All right, fair enough. I want to return for a minute to something you mentioned a few minutes ago. You had talked about the problem of extended vacancies and how this proposal would deal with that by allowing a senior justice to fill in the case of a vacancy, basically. I wondered whether that could actually have a perverse effect. Just as an example, you mentioned now that the first justices in line would be, could be Justice Stevens, followed by Justice Souter. Those are judges that would be preferred by people on the liberal end of the political spectrum, as compared to someone who hypothetically might be nominated by President Trump. So my question is, suppose there was a vacancy and President Trump were in the position of making another Supreme Court appointment.
Okay.
And the alternative to Trump's appointment being confirmed was that one of these retired, senior justices would essentially be in the position of stepping back in. There would be a lot of incentive for people on the, left side of the political spectrum to do everything they could to obstruct a new nomination and appointment to keep that senior justice in place. Now, depending on the age of the senior justice and their willingness to come back and things like that, that might, play into the feasibility. But you see the point that depending on the position of the most recent retired justices compared to, what could be expected of the incoming justices, this may theoretically cause more obstruction of a new appointment.
I think the situation we have right now is untenable. There's already gamesmanship. There's already more partisanship involved in the current system. I honestly don't think it could get any worse. I don't, I'm not convinced by that argument necessarily. And with our proposal, the second Scalia dies on February 13th, on February 14th, John Paul Stevens is sitting in that seat. So yeah, that would be a change of the guard a little bit. But at the same time, then that would, behoove the Republican Congress and the Democratic president to find a consensus candidate, someone more down the line than, say, a Gorsuch or a, I don't know, who are the an Adalberto Jordan. I think that it may encourage, instead of trying to find the most partisan human being you can that can get 51 or 60, well, now 51 votes, maybe it's not bad to have a bunch of more moderate justices enter the court. Maybe that would be an effect of it. So I can see there are a lot of different ways to game this out, but there's already so many potentials for abuse, as we have seen in the last year. And I think that had the shoe been on the other foot, had it been a President Romney and a majority leader Reid, I guess, I would expect a similar situation to have unfolded. But, I think that this proposal at least gives some sort of a greater sense of regularity and less uncertainty. In foreign business and foreign policy, you don't want uncertainty. I think the idea that you'd have this back and forth of is abortion legal? Well, it is this year. Oh, it's not. Is what the death? The death penalty was, it was cruel and unusual. Then it wasn't cruel and unusual. So I think that having some, just at least sort of an expectation of what would be going on would be an improvement over the current situation that yields so much uncertainty.
It's interesting because, again, I can see some counterarguments to that. And you might say that one of the virtues of the current system is that the long tenures of the justices serving on the court tend to add some stability to the court's rulings. You mentioned the 11-year period during the Rehnquist court where there was no change of membership. That was a period of time where a decision made by that court toward the beginning of that period was probably pretty secure for the length of that period. And also, if justices are routinely serving close to 30-year terms on the court, then that means a new justice is added to the court only on average once a term or so.
Mm-hmm.
And that means large shifts in the makeup of the court and the balance between different sides on different issues don't happen that often. Is there a risk that you would see a lot more frequent turnover when, if you had every 2 years a new justice coming on, every 10 years you have five new justices, you've completely changed a majority of the court, you could have swings back and forth more often on a lot of the closely divided issues just due to the change in membership? Is that a risk?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I think that over time you'd find justices that were nominated not from the far ends of I think you'd get more moderate justices over time. I honestly think that would be the result. There's this sort of the zero sum game of, we have to get our guy in the court. Well, I think that would be diminished because A, you've got every term has two bites of the apple, and B, it behooves you to work with the other party, because it could flip in a matter of seconds. Any way to disrupt the system is I think helpful, given that, I don't really see the benefit of having, extremely partisan individuals consistently nominated to the court. And I think that, it's my hope that having sort of this type of turnover would yield a regression to the mean. Could be wrong, but at the very least, the main goal is to sort of, reduce the power of individual judges and justices, add consistency and predictability, and do what we can to prevent against mental decline. Those are really the main takeaways for me. But yeah, I could see how you can make the argument either way, that it's going to yield a certain type of justice. I think it's more moderate, but I've been wrong before. It's possible I'm wrong here.
Right. I think, one of the strongest things going against proposals of this type is you could call it status quo bias. People are used to the way things are and
sure,
afraid of change. But you could also kind of call it a kind of Burkean conservatism,
Yeah.
Just saying changes, especially large structural changes are highly unpredictable. And it's, it's dangerous to go, making large changes when you really can't predict how they're going to play out down the road. And there's maybe a wisdom to either baby steps, unless things are so radically broken that it doesn't work, which, maybe you would argue that it is, that we're already at that point.
I mean, look, there's a potential of having, who knows what Kennedy's going to do, but there's a potential of having a large number of justices who are in their 80s very shortly. And frankly, the last time it happened, when Brennan and Marshall were at their end, they were not in great shape. I mean, this was back in, 1991. That could happen again. As you and your listeners may have noticed, the U.S. only is capable of governing from crisis to crisis these days. So, if a crisis occurs at the Supreme Court, we want to be ready with a solution. And we think that this is one of them. There are other proposals out there, mandatory retirement age, et cetera. But, should a crisis occur and there be a groundswell for support, it is called the Regularization of Supreme Court Term Limits Act of 2017, but, the chances of it being passed this year are very slim. So, it's more the idea of having this proposal out there, having folks talking about it, and then when the time is right, potentially implementing it in a way to stave off a crisis.
Right. That makes sense. Do you have any final thoughts about the term limit proposal that you want to share?
The one thing is this is statutory language. It's ready to go. It's ready to be looked at. But at the same time, this can also be a conversation starter. We want to be clear that the current system of lifetime tenure is not working. It's opens itself up to many abuses. It opens itself up to these interminable tenures that we don't think the founders envisioned. And there's a better way to do it. Every other country, every other state, court of last resort, has found a more accountable and lowercase d democratic way to appoint their top judges. So we don't think the Supreme Court, just because it has the virtue of being older than any of the courts that I mentioned, I mean, that's really the only reason that it has life tenures, that any constitution, whether it be state or federal in another country, that was written in the 20th or 21st century, none of them has life tenure for their justices. So we think there's a reason for that. We think it's time for the U.S. Supreme Court to join state Supreme Courts and the rest of the world and find a reasonable tenure length for its officials, for its justices, and there are a lot of proposals out there. You know, we think this one is good and smart and thoughtful and takes into account a lot of different possibilities. Maybe not everyone. You know, we're willing to work with people who are interested in it and improving it, and that includes members of Congress if they want to take up the mantle. But overall, there's a power problem at the court in terms of, you know, justices staying on for too long and accumulating power and not, you know, maybe having views, as I'm sure you'll see in some of the tech cases coming next term, maybe having views that just don't really comport with where a lot of the American people are. So as much as we may want to look back at the Reagan or the Clinton years as some halcyon days, the fact that the justices from those times are still on the court lo these many years later doesn't really make a lot of sense. So hopefully over time we'll be able to create a court that is more accountable to the American people, that still has independence, that still has a very long tenure, but not so long as to be seeming to be a vestige of feudalism.
Thanks. I really appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation, as it's definitely great food for thought, and I really like thinking about these kind of reforms. If listeners want to learn more about this proposal or the other reforms that you've been advocating, they can go to fixthecourt.com. Is there anywhere else you'd like to direct people to if they want to learn more?
Sure. We have a pretty active social media presence, so twitter.com/fixthecourt, also facebook.com/fixthecourt. And if listeners want to get a daily update as to what is going on, what are the inner workings, what's going on at the Supreme Court, we do it 11 months out of the year, take August off. They can go to scotusdaily.com and just sign up right there on the homepage, and you get it's a daily tip sheet on whatever is happening at the Supreme Court that is goes out around noon Eastern time. It's indispensable, read by all the top SCOTUS reporters and maybe even some of the justices themselves.
That's a great resource. It provides links and kind of short blurbs or summaries of some of the articles and op-eds and things in newspapers and websites. It's a great source to kind of hear what people are talking about. Well, thanks again. I really enjoyed this conversation. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Of course. Thanks so much.
And maybe we could do this again at some point in the future to talk about maybe cameras in the court or other transparency issues.
Sure. We're gonna be going hard to try to get live audio for Trump v. IRAP on October 10th. So you'll be definitely hearing a lot more from us then. SCOTUS has never done live audio for an oral argument, but we think it's time to end that antiquated practice and hopefully get live audio, because they can do live audio from the courtroom. They did for the Scalia Memorial back in November. So we know they have the technological capabilities. They've just never implemented them yet for oral argument. But hopefully come October, we'll have, and especially given the heightened interest of that case and both the gerrymandering case, we may get some live audio, or at least we're going to try.
Well, that's great. I wish you luck on that. I will definitely try and get you back sometime you know, in a few months to talk about that.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mike.
And that brings us to the end of episode 12. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com, including links to Fix the Court's term limits proposal and to SCOTUS Daily, where you can sign up for an email newsletter with links to the latest news and commentary about the Supreme Court. Just a few days ago, after this interview was recorded, Fix the Court put out a term-end report on Supreme Court transparency, summarizing developments over the past year in each of the organization's areas of focus, and we've also linked to that in the show notes. If you want to learn more about Fix the Court and their ideas about reforming the court, you can find them at fixthecourt.com. You can leave comments and questions about the podcast on the show notes post at countingto5.com, that's T-O and the number 5, or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. We're planning to do more interviews in the future, but we really want to hear from you. Tell us what you like and what you don't, and let us know if you have suggestions for future episodes. All feedback is appreciated. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Counting to 5 to make sure you don't miss future episodes. If Counting to 5 is not available in your favorite podcast app, directory, or service, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Finally, if you like Counting to 5, please consider supporting us financially. Go to Counting to 5's Patreon page at patreon.com/countingto5, where you can make a recurring monthly pledge in any amount starting as low as $1. There's no long-term commitment, and you can discontinue your pledge at any time. Patrons can get exclusive rewards, including special mini-explainer episodes, live video chats, bonus audio content, and more. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.